Well, like many of you, I am often asked the question, what do you do? Unlike probably most of you, when I answer the question, I more or less have to identify myself as a follower of Jesus. I'm a pastor, and what kind of pastor, what kind of church, and all that sort of stuff. Eventually, I sort of have to be found out as a follower of Jesus. Then again, there's Ron Ritchie. And Ron Ritchie was a pastor of the church here many years ago. And he didn't really like the question so much, and he had an innovative way of answering the question. So when someone asked him on some occasions what he did, he would say, I'm a teacher. And of course, that would often generate a series of additional questions. Well, what do you teach? I teach literature. Well, what kind of literature? I teach ancient literature. Well, what kind of ancient literature? Ancient biblical literature. So eventually, Ron would usually be found out as being a pastor. Now, he didn't answer the questions this way because he was afraid of being identified as a follower of Jesus. No, he was concerned that being identified as a pastor would be off-putting and would hinder his efforts to share the gospel. How about you? If you are a follower of Jesus, how do you feel about being identified as such in a public setting? What are the potential consequences for being identified as a follower of Jesus? And are there any rewards for being identified as such? In John 8, Jesus identified himself as the light of the world. What happens when we are exposed to the light of Jesus? What happens when we come in contact with the light of the world? What happens in a life? In John chapter 9, we meet a man. We meet a blind man, and a blind man is going to show us. So if you'd like, you can turn to John 9. Certain sections of it are going to appear behind me. It's an enormous chapter. We don't have time to look at all the verses. What we're going to do is tackle this in three parts. First, in the first occasion, we have Jesus interacting with this blind man. In part three, Jesus interacts with the blind man again. In the middle long section, which we are going to consider certain parts of, is what we might consider what we might call the Inquisition, in which this man is called before the Pharisees. First of all, John 9, 1 to 12. As he, that is Jesus, passed by, he saw a blind man from birth, and his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, Go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, Is this not the man who used to sit and beg? Some said, It is he. Others said, No, but he is like him. He kept saying, I am the man. So they said to him, Then how were your eyes opened? He answered, The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, Go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and received my sight. They said to him, Where is he? He said, I do not know. Good question. Where is Jesus? Ask that question, and eventually the answers are going to lead you to him. So we meet this blind man who has been blind from birth, and the disciples falsely assume that his condition is related to his sin or the sin of his parents. And Jesus, of course, says, no, that's not the case. So in a general sense, we might be able to say, and we can say, that all disabilities are related to sin. All illness is related to sin. All death is related to sin. Because God did not create a world in which people are born blind. No, sin has entered the world, sin has corrupted the world, and now we all live to a certain degree afflicted by sin. So in a general sense, yes, sin is responsible. But in a particular sense, you cannot say that every particular disability or affliction or whatnot is directly attributable to a particular sin. In some cases, yes. You might say, for example, crack babies. That's attributable to a parent's sin, the condition of the child. So, Jesus, of course, disabuses the disciples of this notion, and he sees this man. Our text is very clear that Jesus saw the blind man. The blind man cannot see. Other people can't really see the blind man other than his blindness, but Jesus sees the man. And seeing the man, he sees the deeper purposes of God in the man's blindness. He says, "The man was born blind that we might display the works of God." We're going to work the works of God in order to put those works on display for others to see. And he says, "We must do this while it is day." In other words, while Jesus is still here, before darkness closes in, before the crucifixion, we must work the works of God now. Jesus is saying that about his own work in this day, in this particular case. And then he does something from our perspective that would be very strange. He spits on the ground. Have you ever seen a painting or an image of Jesus spitting? No. We don't sort of think of Jesus in that term, going around spitting. And yet here he does. Here's what he does. He spits on the ground. So we ask the question, why is Jesus spitting? Why does he spit on the ground in order to make mud? Okay, go all the way back to creation. How does God create the world? It's in darkness. Everything is in darkness. Everything is in chaos. And out of the darkness and out of the chaos, God says, "Let there be light." And he creates the world out of darkness and chaos. How does he create the first humans? It's out of the dust. Out of the dust of the ground, he creates the first humans, and now Jesus is spitting on the ground and creating something out of the ground. So after this first beautiful, awesome, wonderful creation, sin enters the world through the first humans, and the world is plunged back into chaos and darkness. So what is happening now in the work of Jesus? God is using the darkness and the dust and the chaos of this world and the misery of those who inhabit it. He is gathering all of that up in Jesus Christ in order to create a new world and a new humanity. It's very powerful and very awesome what Jesus does with all of this darkness in the world, all of the chaos in the world, all of the dust in the world. He gathers it up and he uses it, and he in fact is using it right now to bring about and to create a new world and a new humanity. So the man is healed. The man can now see. And those who knew him question whether he in fact is that man, because they can't believe that this has happened to him. And the question comes to the man, "How were your eyes opened?" His answer is, "The man called Jesus opened my eyes." Jesus saw the man, and he saw the deeper purposes of God in the man's blindness. Just as he saw the man, he sees us. He sees us in our limitations. And he sees the deeper purposes of God for us in our limitations. What does he want to do? He wants to work the works of God in us, and he wants to put those works on display for others to see, including watching angels and demons. He wants to work the works of God in us, in and through our limitations. Now, sometimes that involves physical healing, as in the case of this particular man. But oftentimes it doesn't involve that kind of healing. Oftentimes it doesn't involve the kind of healing that we would want. And yet Jesus still wants to use us in our limitations, in the fact that we have not been healed the way we want to be healed, but we have these limitations, and still, especially now, we can display the glory of God through our limitations. We can go all the way back to Exodus chapter 4, verse 11, where Moses was complaining to God because God had called him to lead Israel. And Moses is thinking, "There's no way I can do this because I am not an eloquent speaker." What does the Lord say? The Lord says, "I am not going to heal your tongue," but he does say this, "Who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord?" Doesn't heal Moses. Yet what a leader Moses becomes, because he learns to depend on the Lord in his weakness. In our current day, we might think of Johnny Erickson Tata, who is a strong believer, an incredibly joyful believer in Jesus. She's a quadriplegic. She has not been healed, at least not yet. And she goes around preaching and singing of Jesus. In fact, unbelievably to many people, surprisingly to many people, the song that she has just sung, Alone Yet Not Alone, was just nominated for an Oscar. The small little film, which was hardly released at all, somehow got Oscar attention, and the song was nominated for Best Original Song. Johnny, by the way, preached here 18 years or so ago. I was trying to find it on her website, couldn't find it. But I assure you, she preached here 18 years ago or something like that. Remember, Steve? Yeah, okay, good, it's verified. Johnny was right here, in her and some people were here, in the wheelchair, preaching. Okay, good. So there's this French philosopher, or there was this French philosopher by the name of Simone Weil, and she used to struggle with these incredibly violent headaches, and she was raised as an atheist. And she came upon this poem by George Herbert called Love. And during her headaches, she would recite this poem, and it became a thing that she had memorized. And she would oftentimes, when she had these headaches, recall that poem. And here's what she said. I used to think I was merely reciting it as a beautiful poem, but without my knowing it, the recitation had the virtue of a prayer. It was during one of these recitations that Christ himself came down and took possession of me. In my arguments about the insolubility of the problem of God, I had never foreseen the possibility of that, of a real contact, person to person, here below, between a human being and God. And she continued to suffer tremendous health problems, but she continued to write of her glimpses of glory, those times in which Christ revealed himself to her, all the way up to her death at age 34 in 1943 from tuberculosis. So we were born with limitations, and we were born with limitations in order to glorify God, however God chooses to use those limitations or overcome those limitations. He opened the eyes of the blind man here, not primarily to heal him, not primarily so that he could see physically, but so that he could see spiritually. He opened the eyes of the blind man so that he could see the truth of who Jesus is, as we shall see as we work our way through the chapter. So the first thing, then, that Jesus does as he approaches us in our spiritually darkened state is to touch us and to open our eyes so that we can see something of him, so that we can get a glimpse of his glory, so that we can begin this journey of enlightenment with him. And perhaps after he does so, some people will say, looking at us as we are now, compared to what we were before, like they said of the blind man, is this the same person? That's the power of Jesus in a life. It can be that powerful and that strong so that after Jesus meets you, you change, and people will look at that change and say, is this the same man? Is this the same woman? Now, you would think that after being healed of this affliction, this lifelong affliction of blindness, that now life is going to get easier for the man. Isn't life going to be so much easier if I'm healed of this affliction? Isn't life for us going to be so much easier if Jesus would touch us the way we want him to touch us, so that we are healed in some way, or so that whatever the affliction is that we are dealing with is no longer present? Then life is going to get easier, right? That's what we hope. That's what we think. It doesn't happen that way for this man. So here we enter into the long intervening section, the Inquisition. But first of all, we need a little bit of background information. Jesus has healed this man on the Sabbath, which gets him in hot water with the Pharisees. To the Pharisees, the Sabbath was very important, and you have to understand something of the political nature of this. Whether you kept the Sabbath in Jesus' day and how you kept it demonstrated whose side you were on. The Pharisees, by and large, were nationalists. Nationalists wanted to keep the Sabbath. They wanted to be really holy before God to indicate that they were loyal to God. They were loyal to Israel. And especially, they were loyal to the resistance movement. So that the Pharisees and people like them, by and large, wanted to be liberated from Rome, which was the oppressing power of the day. And if you kept the Sabbath, you said, hey, that's what side we're on. And Jesus, of course, challenges that whole view. He is not a nationalist. He does not come alongside that agenda. So he is a threat to the Pharisees because he is generating a following. He challenges the whole notion of how they are thinking about the Sabbath. So now we have this inquisition. So we have a man that has been healed by Jesus, but the Pharisees can't have that because that would seem to validate Jesus as this new teacher, preacher, possible Messiah, whatever, who's generating this following. And so they bring the friends bring the man before the Pharisees, and they have this inquisition. So they are trying to find some sort of evidence by which Jesus can be discredited. So the man has to tell his story, verse 15. So the Pharisees asked him again how he had received his sight. And he said to them, "He put mud on my eyes, and I washed, and I see." The man, by the way, in this text is asked the question, what happened to him, three times. That can get very infuriating, right? If you're asked the same question over and over again, it's very difficult. Nevertheless, the man sticks to his story. Jesus has healed him. What does the man think of Jesus? Verse 17. So they again said to the blind man, "What do you say about him, since he has supposedly opened your eyes?" He said, "He is a prophet." Okay, so first of all, he identified Jesus as a man, the man called Jesus. Now he identifies him as a prophet. The man's sight is improving. Next, the Pharisees call in the man's parents. They want to sort of understand this whole history of this guy. Was he really born blind? They call in the parents, and the parents verify that, in fact, he was born blind. But the parents are not going to go all that far in identifying with their son who identifies with Jesus. They are afraid of being put out of the synagogue because the Pharisees had made it clear that if you really identify with Jesus, especially if you call him the Messiah, that you're going to be kicked out of the synagogue. And that was a very big deal. It's a much bigger deal than getting kicked out of a church. To get kicked out of the synagogue back then meant to be kicked out of the community, and you would have to fend for yourself. So the parents refuse to stand with their son, and they say, "Well, you can talk to him. He is of age. He can speak for himself, but we're not going to really identify with Jesus." So what do the Pharisees do? They recall the man. Bring that guy over one more time. Let's kind of go over the same territory. Let's see if there's anything we've missed. Let's cover that same ground. Let's see if there's anything out there that we can get that seems to discredit Jesus. So they put the screws to the man. They put the pressure on the formerly blind man. And they say, "We know that this man is a sinner." How does the man answer that question? He says this. Verse 25, and he answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, that though I was blind, now I see." Very simple, very profound, very courageous. "This is what I know. I can't really speak to his past. I don't know the man. I have no history with the man. I don't know whether he's a sinner. But I do know this. This was my condition at one point. This is my condition now. It has changed because of this particular man. He has opened my eyes. I was blind. Now I see." He speaks to what he knows. He does not speak to what he doesn't know. And then finally, he understands what is going on here, that the Pharisees are not interested in the truth. They are only interested in evidence that is going to discredit Jesus. So he turns the tables on the Pharisees very courageously and sardonically. He accuses them. He says, "Well, do you continue to ask all of these questions about Jesus? And if you continue to do all of this, are you really interested in more information about him so that you too can become his followers?" And the Pharisees at this point become unglued. They can't have this. And the Pharisees revile the man and they ridicule him for supposedly teaching them. They who know so much, he who knows so little. How can he teach them? What does the man say? Verse 33. "If this man, Jesus, were not from God, he could do nothing." And now the man is clearly on the side of Jesus, identifying him as coming from God. What do the Pharisees do? They show him the door. The parents were not kicked out of the synagogue. The son is kicked out of the synagogue for standing up for the truth of what happened to him, for sharing honestly and boldly about his experience of Jesus. Likewise, for many of us who follow Jesus, we face certain questions, don't we? Perhaps we even face certain accusations. And you are questioned and you're accused, perhaps, for being foolish, for believing in all of this nonsense, all of this Jesus nonsense. How can you believe that in this day and age? You're a fool for believing it. Or perhaps we are questioned and accused by people who are threatened by faith in Jesus. They are worried that, boy, if there are too many of these evangelicals around, that's really going to make things hard for the rest of us. It's going to destroy our worldview or infringe upon what we are believing. So people feel threatened by faith in Jesus. And in our post-Christian America, isn't this anti-evangelical bias just sort of in the air? You can almost breathe it, right? It's all over the place, and it's enough to really kind of make you want to keep faith in the closet. Many of us then end up feeling ridiculed, if not actually, then in our minds we think people are doing this for knowing so little, but actually thinking that we have something instructive to say. And because of that, many of us are excluded, like the formerly blind man. We are kicked out of something, or we're afraid we're going to be kicked out of something. Doors closed to us because we are followers of Jesus, perhaps. And perhaps even those that we might have counted on to stand with us fall away from us if we stand up for Jesus, just like the parents refused to stand up for their son. Now, many of us don't face this sort of thing in an overt way. It's a subtle thing. But it's powerful in its subtlety, so powerful that it can make you want to keep faith in Jesus in the closet, to hide the fact that you are a follower of Jesus, to prevent yourself from identifying with him. Jan English Luck is a San Jose State anthropology professor, and she was recently quoted in a very interesting article in the Financial Times called Valley of God. Valley of God meaning the Silicon Valley, which doesn't really care for God all that much, but there are believers in the Silicon Valley. But she says that those believers tend to keep faith in the closet. They keep very quiet about their faith because the ultimate thing, the important thing in the Silicon Valley, if you are working here, is to get the job done. And faith gets in the way of getting the job done. And here's what she said in that article. Dogmatic faith would get in the way of good work relationships, and that is the true sin in Silicon Valley. Interesting. Faith being equated with sin. Biblically, faith is the answer to sin. And now, she says, in the Silicon Valley, faith, especially dogmatic faith, if you really stick to your story, the way the man stuck to his story, that's the true sin. My goodness. So, what do we do in the face of all of this? What did the man do? He stood up for the truth. That's what we do. Stand up for the truth. You don't know everything. The man did not know everything. But you do know some things. Answer the questions as best you can. The questions you don't know, be free about it. Say, I don't know the answer to that question, but you do know some things. Especially, you know what has happened to you. You know what Jesus has done in your own life. You have a personal experience with Jesus, if you are a follower of his. Therefore, you can speak to what Jesus has done for you. There is one thing that you are the foremost authority on in the entire world. It is your own life. And no one can speak about your own life the way that you can. And that is a powerful story. Speak of your own experience of Jesus. When you are given the opportunity, when the door opens, tell your own story. Speak of your own experience of Jesus. Speak what you know, come what may. I'll be honest with you. My fear in identifying myself as a pastor is being labeled. And that's, I'm sure, the fear of many of you as well. No one likes being labeled. So when I identify myself as a pastor, I'm asked what I do. I answer that question that way. Sometimes it generates a series of follow-up questions, and eventually they ask me what kind of church I'm a pastor of. And I can just see the wheels turning. And I answer the question, and they're usually, the mouth drops open a little bit sometimes. Oh, boy, I didn't know one of those. He's one of those? Not only is he one of those, but he's a leader of one of those. And that oftentimes will close down the conversation real quick. They don't really want to talk anymore once I identify myself as a pastor. When I was a journalist, I enjoyed being asked that question. What do you do? I'm a reporter, when I was a reporter, or I'm an editor. They didn't know many reporters. They didn't know many editors, and it wasn't threatening. They wanted to know about that, so it opened a door for conversation. On the other hand, usually when I say I'm a pastor and they find out what kind of pastor, the door closes. Not always, but most of the time. What I do, eventually I just say, what kind of church are we? We're followers of Jesus. That's what I say. We're followers of Jesus. Now, they're going to have all kinds of ideas of what that looks like and what that means, but I'm just going to get Jesus out there. I'm going to say, we're followers of Jesus. I'm going to identify with Jesus. If I'm going down, I'm going down with Jesus, right? Just, you know, it's Jesus. I'm with him, okay? I know you got some weird ideas about that, and I know you got me labeled, but that's okay. I'm going down with Jesus. Several years ago, after I married Karen, who was a grad student at Stanford at the time, I got to play at the Stanford golf course. Oh, this was a great privilege because I could play for student rates, $18.50. So every once in a while, I would go up to this world-class golf course because I could now play it. Played it for about 3 years, about once a month or so, I would go on up there. And as a single player, I would get grouped with who knows who, and I got to meet all sorts of interesting people. And so this one particular time, I was on the putting green getting ready for my time, and then I heard over the loudspeaker the calling to the tee box, the foursome that was to play. It was Shumway, threesome, Grant, single. So, okay, I'm making my way to the tee box for my tee time in order to start playing golf, and I'm thinking to myself, Shumway. Okay, there's something about that name, Shumway. Okay, I'm at Stanford, Shumway. Doctor, right, doctor? Shumway, surgeon, famous heart surgeon. Wait a second. Okay, the wheels are turning. Heart transplant, right? Didn't he do heart transplant work? And so these things are all going through my mind as I'm going up to the tee box. And how do I find out whether this is actually some famous Dr. Shumway or not? I go to the tee box, and the starter says to me, well, I'm the first one there. The Shumway threesome hasn't arrived yet. The starter says to me, well, if you have a heart attack out there, today shouldn't be a problem. So, now I know I'm playing with the Dr. Shumway, who is some sort of famous heart surgeon. So, but how do I find out more information about this? And so I'm walking down the first fairway with him after we have hit our tee shots, and I say to him, so I understand that you're the Dr. Shumway. And he says, well, yes, I'm one of them. Turns out his daughter is also a surgeon. So yes, this was the Dr. Shumway, Dr. Norman Shumway, who was the father of heart transplantation, performed the first successful heart transplant in North America. He pioneered all of the work in heart transplantation. And so he is very gracious, and he asks me, of course, what do I do? Okay, so I tell this world-famous heart surgeon, I tell him I'm a pastor. And I don't remember it going any further than that on the front nine. On the back nine, however, I asked him, he was retired at this point, and he was a professor emeritus, I think, at the medical school, but he wasn't able to operate anymore. He was in his 70s. So I asked him, do you miss surgery? And he says to me, I wouldn't tell this to anybody but my pastor. But, and then he really opened his heart to me. And he says, oh, you have no idea how much I miss surgery. It was just like his whole life was surgery. I mean, and he said, I would be in the operating theater, and 8 hours would go by, and 12 hours would go by, and I couldn't believe it. I look up at the clock, and I couldn't believe that much time had passed because it felt like a minute. He was doing what he loved. He was doing what God had put him on the earth to do, whether he knew that or not. And so here was a thing, it opened up a door. It didn't go any further than that, but it opened up the door. And sometimes, if you identify yourself as a follower of Jesus, doors are going to close. Sometimes, doors are going to open. And you never know what's in somebody's heart, and you never know what is going to be accessed in somebody's heart if you identify with Jesus. So, there is a cost for identifying with Jesus. There is a cost for this man, this formerly blind man, for identifying with Jesus. He is kicked out of the synagogue. Is there a reward that comes with being identified with Jesus? John 9, verse 35. Jesus heard that they had cast him, that is the blind man, out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, "Are we also blind?" And Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, 'We see,' your guilt remains." So the man is cast out of the synagogue, but he is cast into the arms of Jesus. Jesus knows exactly what has happened to him, and Jesus comes looking for him. And he asks him a question. "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" The Son of Man, from Daniel chapter 7, is a representative figure of the people of God. He is seen in this vision of ascending to God, ascending to the Ancient of Days, and receiving this everlasting kingdom. Do you believe in the Son of Man? This man is eager to believe whatever Jesus says because he has already identified Jesus as a prophet and Jesus has healed him. So yes, he wants to believe. Who is he? Jesus answers the question, "I am he." And the man falls down and he worships. He worships Jesus. Whether he recognizes Jesus as God incarnate at this point or not, we don't know. Nevertheless, we know that John has identified Jesus as God incarnate. And in the end, the Pharisees are blind. They cannot see Jesus. They cannot see him as the Son of Man. They cannot see him as the Messiah. And the blind man sees in more ways than one. Notice the journey of the blind man in this chapter. He comes a long way in a short time. First, he identified Jesus as a man. Then he identified him as a prophet. Then he said he is from God. Then he believes in Jesus as the Son of Man. And finally, he worships Jesus. Jesus knew what happened to the man. He knows what happens to us. He knows of all of the difficulties. He knows of all of the confrontations. He knows of all of the rejections. But you need to know this. If you stand up for the truth, if you stand up for Jesus, Jesus is going to come looking for you. That's what he did with the man. He came looking for the man. And if you are cast out in any way, you are cast in to the arms of Jesus. Then what does Jesus do? What does he do for you? What does he give you? What did he give the man? He gives you more truth. He gives you more truth. Stand up for the truth to get more truth. You get more to believe, or you get a greater appreciation for what you already believe. And this is truth that you're ready for. It's not simply more facts. It may be that, but it is more than that. It is somehow you are ready to believe this. And somehow you need to believe this, whatever this truth is. And it hits you in just the right way, at just the right time, so that you are able to believe it and embrace it. And you need this for the next step in your journey. And perhaps you need this for the rest of your life. And Jesus gives that truth to you. Mostly, he gives you a better vision of himself. That's what happened for this man. He got a better vision as the chapter went on of who Jesus was. We get a better vision of who Jesus is. In keeping with our poetry day, we have Emily Dickinson, one of the great American poets, and she says this: "The truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind." You see, no one gets all of the truth in one shot. You can't get all of Jesus in one shot. It wouldn't make any sense. We get Jesus incrementally. We get truth incrementally, in glimpses of glory, up until the final day when Jesus returns in full glory to consummate the kingdom of God. Increasingly, I am aware of the lostness around me. I see it in the faces in people. I walk around and I see the lostness. I see the emptiness. I see the pain. Increasingly, I am appreciative that Jesus has found me. He knows what I have gone through, and he has found me. Increasingly, because of the lostness, I feel compelled to stand up for the truth. How about you? Many of us sort of pull back from this whole concept of evangelism. It frightens us. We don't know what to do about it. We fear that we are not gifted evangelists. We fear that we will not be effective. We don't know what to say. We don't know when to say it. We stumble over our words. We're cowards. And all of this, we have all of these fears about sharing the gospel, and we are afraid that we are going to be ineffective. Notice the man in John chapter 9. He is completely ineffective. As it concerns leading anyone to Christ, he is completely ineffective. In fact, the Pharisees become even more hardened in their resistance to Jesus. Nevertheless, Jesus rewards him. Jesus honors him. Jesus seeks him out, not for his effectiveness, but for his boldness, for his courage. I was reading Philippians chapter 1 recently and was struck that Paul rejoiced that the gospel was being preached. He's in prison, but because he's in prison, others are out there preaching, others are motivated to preaching, and he says nothing about the effect of their preaching. He simply rejoices that the gospel is being preached, regardless of how effective it is. That's the victory when the gospel is preached, when Jesus is shared. So, proclaim Jesus. Especially, share your own experience of Jesus when given the opportunity. Proclaim Jesus and rejoice, regardless of what happens. Be strong and courageous, Peninsula Bible Church. Stand up for the truth, especially the truth of your own experience of Jesus, in order to get more truth, especially truth as it concerns who Jesus is, to get those glimpses of glory. To finish things off, let's listen to more poetry. The sweet singer of Israel, David himself. "For my father and mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me in." Amen.